can you tell me the story again?
All right, we're alive.
Hey.
Yeah.
I'm alive.
Yep. So, how have you been?
Fine. How have you been? I'm tired.
I've been okay. I'm not enjoying the fact that we went from spring last weekend to lies, deceit, and terribleness this weekend.
Don't even get it wrong. Like, it was like 60 yesterday.
Yeah.
When I left work, it was like 55.
Yeah.
I leave my house an hour later, and it's snowing.
Yeah. I mean, granted, thankfully the roads are like perfect. Like
it
just did exactly what I think a lot of people like the snow to do. Look pretty in our yards, and that's it.
Yeah, but like, come on now. I felt really deceived because I backed out of my garage and I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
Plus, when I was leaving last night, I got a snowball started coming at me from behind. And I turned and I was like, you see these little kids that were there? No, it's my fully grown, like 10 years older than me cousins throwing snowballs at me. Men in their 40s throwing snowballs at me as I walk away.
That sounds right. I mean,
you guys are rude. This is why your children are hellions.
Listen, men get older. We don't grow up.
I can tell.
Yeah, no.
This is for you, Paul, throwing snowballs at me. And he goes, Rachel, I got a snowball coming your way.
Hey,
like,
don't insult one of maybe our only 10 listeners.
I don't think he listens, but
never mind.
He knows.
Never mind, insult away.
This is why Ivan is terrible, and you named your child Ivan, first of all. So of course he has the personality of Ivan. No, he's a cute kid. But he was running through the party, like swinging his arms everywhere, and like his maniac smile on his face. It was adorable, yet terrifying.
Okay.
Children.
Yeah, they're a thing.
I just thought that's who was throwing snowballs at me. It was not.
No. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
But it's okay, because it is, like, perfect snowball weather.
It is. Yeah, that was nice and, like, mushy snow.
Yeah, so it was warm enough that it, like, stuck together.
Yeah. Yeah.
They never hit me, because they're not that good at aiming, I guess, but...
Or you're just that good at dodging. Don't give them the credit. You're just that skilled.
I'm a ninja.
You're just that skilled at dodging. You moved so slightly imperceptibly that they couldn't account for it and they missed.
That's exactly what it was. That's why I was wearing dress shoes. So
yeah.
To walk through the snow in dress shoes.
That's even more impressive than
dodging snowballs.
That's even more impressive. See?
Yeah. No, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, hello, everybody. I'm Jeff.
I'm Rachel.
And this is Grandma Tell Me a Scary Story, the podcast.
Yes, it's the podcast.
Yeah. So, today we have some... Well, you can either look at this one of two ways. I'm choosing to look at it in the nice way, which is we have a special treat for you. But you can also look at it as we were too lazy to write actual notes, as today we have a story time.
Yay. I don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah. So, we're looking at today... Well, we're also mixing up a little bit even more because... The story I chose was way too long to be one episode, so we're going to be doing a two-parter with this.
Yay, two-parters!
Yeah, so we'll do
part... It's been a while.
So we'll do part one today, and then next week will be part two. That way you don't have a long break between them to forget and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So today will be part one of The Murdered Cousin by...
The title just gets me every time. It makes me giggle. That's probably not a good thing. Sorry, Paul.
Probably not. So it was written by a Mr. Joseph Thomas Sheridan Lee Fanju. I think I probably butchered the pronunciation, but that's fine because I do that always. He actually went by his, I guess, middle and last name, which is Sheridan Lee Fanju, when he was writing. And he was born in August of 1814.
Hey, August, yeah.
And died in February of 1873.
Oh, how weird. He died. Probably died on his half birthday.
Yeah. Not quite. But he was an Irish writer of gothic tales, mystery novels, and horror fiction.
So it's like perfect.
Yeah. He was actually a leading ghostwriter of his time.
Yeah.
So he kind of like... helped make that genre of stories.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love him.
And he is most famous. Well, I think he's most famous because I've actually read this one. The other one I haven't heard of. So like there's three of his best works. The three best works that he has are called, one's called Uncle Silas, which is a Locked Room mystery story.
So I don't Sounds creepy.
Which I kind of want to read now.
Yeah.
We have the air quotes here because I don't really want to sign this to him. Like, people are saying it, but I don't know about, like, I read it and I didn't get that vibe, but the lesbian vampire novella Carmilla.
Okay.
So briefly with that, it's just because it's a girl vampire stalking a female victim.
Okay, but like, vampires gotta eat.
They do, but I guess if literary analysts have detected some romantic overtures between the two. And
I mean, that's, I don't care either way.
Well, I don't either, but I'm also thinking, like, you are aware of, like, the Victorian era style of writing where, like, friendships are, like in today's standards of friendships, they're greatly romanticized. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. And then he has a historical novel called The House by the Churchyard, which I also have not read. I've only read Carmilla, and once again, I just got, oh, it's the Victorian era style of friendship where, like, it's kind of a romantic.
Mm-hmm. No, I like vampires, so that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, like, even in this story, like, you kind of pick up, like, our protagonist and one of her relatives, like, they become fast friends, and you're like...
Yeah. I feel like people over-romanticize things all the time.
I do, too, but... Which maybe says something about our society nowadays, too. That we over-romanticize everything.
Yes, I think people over-romanticize everything.
Yeah. So, anyway, without getting in too much of the murdered cousin before we actually start hearing about it.
it kills me.
I'm going to just leave it at that. That's all the development I'm going to give you for that. So, on that note, we'll take a quick little break with from our sponsor, as we usually do, but one of these things. We'll read part of the story, and then we probably won't come back today. We'll probably talk about it before we start part two.
Sounds good.
All right. So, on that note, here is a word from us about sponsors.
The Murdered Cousin by Sheridan Lee Fanu. This story of the Irish peerage is written, as nearly as possible, in the very words in which it was related by its heroine, the late Countess D, and is therefore told in first person. My mother died when I was an infant, and of her I have no recollection, even the faintest. By her death, my education was left solely to the direction of my surviving parent. He entered upon his task with a stern appreciation of the responsibility thus cast upon him. My religious instruction was prosecuted with an almost exaggerated anxiety, and I had, of course, the best masters to perfect me in all those accomplishments which my station and wealth might seem to require. My father was what is called an oddity, and his treatment of me, though less uniformly kind, was governed less by affection and tenderness than by a high and unbending sense of duty. Indeed, I seldom saw or spoke to him except at mealtimes. And then, though gentle, he was usually reserved and gloomy. His leisure hours were, which were many, were passed either in his study or in solitary walks. In short, he seemed to take no further interest in my happiness or improvement than a conscientious regard to the discharge of his own duty would seem to impose. Shortly before my birth, an event occurred which had contributed much to induce and to confirm my father's unsocial habits. It was the fact that a suspicion of murder had befallen upon his younger brother, though not sufficiently definite to lead to any public proceedings, yet strong enough to ruin him in public opinion. This disgraceful and dreadful doubt cast upon the family name, my father felt deeply and bitterly, and not the less so that he himself was thoroughly convinced of his brother's innocence. The sincerity and strength of this conviction he shortly afterwards proved in a manner which produced the catastrophe of my story. Before, however, I enter unto my immediate adventures, I ought to relate the circumstances which had awakened that suspicion to which I have referred, inasmuch as they are in themselves somewhat curious, and in their effects most intimately connected with my own after history. My uncle, Sir Arthur Tyrrell, was a gay and extravagant man, and, among other vices, was ruinously addicted to gaming. This unfortunate propensity, even after his fortune had suffered so severely as to render retrenchment imperative, nevertheless continued to engross him, nearly to the exclusion of every other pursuit. He was, however, a proud, or rather, a vain man, and could not bear to make the diminution of his income a matter of triumph to those whom he had hitherto competed, and, The consequence was that he frequented no longer the expensive haunts of his dissipation, and retired from the gay world, leaving his coterie to discover his reasons as best they might. He did not, however, forego his favorite vice, for though he could not worship his great divinity in those costly temples where he was formerly wont to take his place, yet he found it very possible to bring about him a sufficient number of the votaires of chance to answer all his ends. The consequence was that Carrickley, which was the name of my uncle's residence, was never without one or more of such visitors as I have described. It happened that upon one occasion he was visited by one Hugh Tisdall, a gentleman of loose, and indeed low, habits, but of considerable wealth, and who had, in early youth, traveled with my uncle upon the continent. The period of this visit was winter, and consequently the house was nearly deserted, excepting by its ordinary inmates. It was, therefore, highly acceptable, and particularly as my uncle was aware that his visitor's tastes accorded exactly with his own. Both parties seemed determined to avail themselves of their mutual suitability during the brief stay which Mr. Tisdall had promised. The consequence was that they shut themselves up in Sir Arthur's private room for nearly all the day and the greater part of the night, during the space of almost a week, and at once, and at the end of which, the servant having some morning, as usual, knocked at Mr. Tisdall's bedroom door repeatedly, received no answer, and upon attempting to enter, found that it was locked. This appeared suspicious, and the inmates of the house having been alarmed, the door was forced open, and, on proceeding to the bed, they found the body of its occupant perfectly lifeless and hanging halfway out, the head downwards and near the floor. One deep wound had been inflicted upon the temple, apparently with some blunt instrument, which had penetrated the brain, and another blow, less effective, probably the first, aimed, had grazed his head, removing some of the scalp. The door had been double locked from the inside, and evidence of which the key still lay where it had been placed in the lock. The window, though not secured on the interior, was closed, a circumstance not a little puzzling, as it afforded the only other mode of escape from the room. It looked out, too, upon a kind of courtyard round which the old building stood, formerly accessible by a narrow doorway and passage lining the oldest side of the quadrangle, but which had since been built up so as to preclude all ingress or egress. The room was also upon the second story, and the height of the window considerable, in addition to all which the stone window was much too narrow to allow any one's standing upon it when the window was closed. Near the bed were found a pair of razors belonging to the murdered man, one of them upon the ground, and both of them open. The weapon which inflicted the mortal wound was not found in the room, nor were any footsteps or other traces of the murderer discoverable. At the suggestion of Sir Arthur himself, the coroner was instantly summoned to attend, and an inquest was held. Nothing, however, in any degree conclusive was elicited. The walls, ceilings, and floor of the room were carefully examined in order to ascertain whether they contained a trapdoor or other concealed mode of entrance, but no such thing appeared. Such was the minuteness of the investigation employed, that although the grate had contained a large fire during the night, they proceeded to examine even the very chimney in order to discover whether escape by it was possible. But this attempt, too, was fruitless. For the chimney, built in the old fashion, rose in a perfectly perpendicular line from the hearth to a height of nearly 14 feet above to the roof, according in its interior scarcely the possibility of ascent. The flue, being smoothly plastered and sloping towards the top like an inverted funnel, promising, too, even if the summit were attained, owing to its great height, but a precarious descent upon the sharp and steep ridge roof. The ashes, too, which lay on the grate, and the soot as far as it could be seen, were undisturbed, a circumstance almost conclusive upon the point. Sir Arthur was, of course, cross was examined, his evidence was given with clearness and unreserve, which seemed calculated to silence all suspicion. He stated that up to the day and night immediately preceding the catastrophe, he had lost to a heavy amount, but that, at their last sitting, he had only won back his original loss, but upwards of £4,000 in addition. At evidence of which he produced an acknowledgment of debt to that amount in the handwriting of the deceased, bearing date the night of the catastrophe. He had mentioned the circumstance to Lady Tyrrell and in presence of some of his domestics, which statement was supported by their respective evidence. One of the jury shrewdly observed that the circumstance of Mr. Tisdall's having sustained so heavy a loss might have suggested to some ill-minded persons accidentally hearing it, the plan of robbing him after having murdered him in such a manner as might make it appear that he had committed suicide, a suspicion which was strongly supported by the razors having been found thus displaced and removed from their case. Two persons had probably been engaged in the attempt, one watching by the sleeping man, ready to strike him in case of his awakening suddenly, while the other was procuring the razors and employed in inflicting the fatal gash so as to make it appear to have been the act of the murdered man himself. It is said that while the juror was making the suggestion, Sir Arthur changed color. There was nothing, however, like legal evidence to implicate him, and the consequence was that the verdict was found against a person or persons unknown, and for some time the matter was suffered to rest, until, after about 5 months, my father received a letter from a person signing himself Andrew Collis and representing himself to be the cousin of the deceased. This letter stated that his brother, Sir Arthur, was likely to incur not merely suspicion but personal risk, unless he would account for certain circumstances connected with the recent murder, and contained a copy of a letter written by the deceased and dated the very day upon the night of which the murder had been perpetrated. Tisdale's letter contained, among a great deal of other matter, the passages which follow. I have had sharp work with Sir Arthur. He tried some of his stale tricks, but soon found that I was Yorkshire, too. It would not do, you understand me. We went to the work like good ones, head, heart, and soul, and in fact, since I came here, I have lost no time. I am rather fagged, but I am sure to be well paid for my hardship. I never want sleep, so as long as I can have the music of a dice box and wherewithal to pay the piper. As I told you, he tried some of his queer turns, but I foiled him like a man, and in return gave him more than he could relish of the genuine dead knowledge. In short, I have plucked the old baronet as never baronet was plucked before. I have scarce left him the stump of a quill. I have got promissory notes in his hand to the amount of, if you like round numbers, say 5,000 and 20,000 pounds, safely deposited in my portable strongbox, alias double-clasped pocketbook. I leave this ruin and old rat hole early on tomorrow for two reasons. First, I ought to play with Sir Arthur deeper than I think his security would warrant, and secondly, because I am safer 100 miles away from Sir Arthur than the house with him. Look, you, my worthy, I tell you this between ourselves. I may be wrong, but, by, I am sure as that I am now living, that Sir Arthur attempted to poison me last night. So much for old friendship on both sides. When I won the last stake, a heavy one enough, my friend leant his forehead upon his hands, and you'll laugh when I tell you that his head literally smoked like a hot dumpling. I don't know whether his agitation was produced by the plan which he had against me, or by his having lost so heavily. Though it must be allowed that he had reason to be a little funked, whichever way his thoughts went. But he pulled the bell and ordered two bottles of champagne. While the fellow was bringing them, he wrote a promissory note to the full amount, which he signed, and, as the man came in with the bottles and glasses, he desired him to be off. He filled a glass for me, and while he thought my eyes were off, for I was putting up his note at the time, he dropped something slyly into it, no doubt to sweeten it. But I saw it all, and when he handed it to me, I said, with an emphasis which he might easily understand, "There is some sediment in it. I'll not drink it, is there?" said he, and at the same time snatched it from my hand and threw it into the fire. "What do you think of that? Have I not a tender bird in hand, win or lose? I will not play beyond 5,000 tonight. And tomorrow sees me safe out of the reach of Sir Arthur's champagne." Of the authenticity of this document, I never heard my father express a doubt, and I am satisfied that, owing to his strong conviction in favor of his brother, he would not have admitted it without sufficient inquiry, inasmuch as it had tended to confirm the suspicions which already existed to his prejudice. Now, the only point in which this letter was made strongly against my uncle was the mention of the double-clasped pocketbook as the receptacle of the papers likely to involve him. For this pocketbook was not forthcoming, nor anywhere to be found, nor had any papers referring to his gaming transactions been discovered upon the dead man. But whatever might have been the original intention of this man, Collis, neither my uncle nor my father ever heard more of him. He published the letter, however, in Faulkner's newspaper, which was shortly afterwards made the vehicle of a much more mysterious attack. The passage in that journal to which I allude appeared about 4 years afterwards, and while the fatal occurrence was still fresh in public recollection, it commenced by a rambling preface stating that a certain person, whom certain persons thought to be dead, was not so, but living, and in full possession of his memory, and moreover, ready and able to make great delinquents tremble. It then went on to describe the murder, without, however, mentioning names, and in doing so, it entered into minute and circumstantial particulars of which none but an eyewitness could have possessed, and by implications almost too unequivocal to be regarded in light of insinuation to involve the titled gambler in the guilt of the transaction. My father at once urged Sir Arthur to proceed against the paper in an action of libel, but he would not hear of it, nor consent to my father's taking any legal steps whatever in the matter. My father, however, wrote in a threatening tone to Faulkner, demanding a surrender of the author of the obnoxious article. The answer to this application is still in my possession and is penned in an apologetic tone. It states that the manuscript had been handed in, paid for, and inserted as an advertisement without sufficient inquiry or any knowledge as to whom it referred. No step, however, was taken to clear my uncle's character in the judgment of the public, and, as he immediately sold a small property, the application of the proceeds of which were known to none, he was said to have disposed of it to enable himself to buy off the threatened information. However, the truth might have been, it is certain that no charges respecting the mysterious murder were afterwards publicly made against my uncle, and, as far as external disturbances were concerned, he enjoyed henceforward perfect security and quiet. A deep and lasting impression, however, had been made upon the public mind, and Sir Arthur Tyrrell was no longer visited or noticed by the gentry of the county, whose attentions he had hitherto received. He accordingly affected to despise those courtesies which he no longer enjoyed, and shunned even that society which he might have commanded. This is all that I need recap of my uncle's history, and I now recur onto my own. Although my father had never, within my recollection, visited or been visited by my uncle, even being of unsocial, procrastinating, and indolent habits, and their respective residences being very far apart, the one lying in the county of Galway and the other in that of Cork, he was strongly attached to his brother, and evinced his affection by an active correspondence, and by deeply and proudly resenting that neglect which had branded Sir Arthur as unfit to mix in society. When I was about 18 years of age, my father, whose health had been gradually dwindling, died, leaving me in heart-wrenched and desolate, and, owing to his habitual seclusion, with few acquaintances and almost no friends. The provisions of his will were curious, and when I was sufficiently come to myself to listen to or comprehend them, surprised me not a little. All his vast property was left to me and to the heirs of my body forever, and, in default of such heirs, it was to go after my death to my uncle, Sir Arthur, without any entail. At the same time, the will appointed him my guardian, desiring that I might be received within his house and reside with his family and under his care during the term of my minority, and in consideration of the increased expense consequent upon such an arrangement, a handsome allowance was allotted to him during the term of my proposed residence. The object of this last provision I at once understood. My father desired, by making it the direct apparent interest of Sir Arthur, that I should die without issue, while at the same time he placed my person wholly in his power to prove to the world how great and unshaken was his confidence in his brother's innocence and honor. It was strange, perhaps an idle scheme, but as I had always been brought up in the habit of considering my uncle as a deeply injured man, and had been taught, almost as part of my religion, to regard him as the very soul of honor, I felt no further uneasiness respecting the arrangement that likely to affect a shy and timid girl at the immediate prospect of taking up her abode for the first time in her life among strangers. Previous to leaving my home, which I felt I should do with a heavy heart, I received a most tender and affectionate letter from my uncle, calculated, if anything could do so, to remove the bitterness of parting from scenes familiar and dear from my earliest childhood, and in some degree to reconcile me to the measure. It was upon a fine day in autumn that I approached the old dominion of Carricklee. I shall not soon forget the impression of sadness and of gloom which all that I saw produced upon my mind. The sunbeams were falling with a rich and melancholy luster upon the fine old trees which stood in lordly groups, casting their long, sweeping shadows over the rock and sward. There was an air of neglect and decay about the spot, which amounted almost to desolation, and mournfully increased as we approached the building itself, near which the ground had been originally more artificially and carefully cultivated than anything else, and where consequently neglect more immediately and strikingly betrayed itself. As we proceeded, the road wound near the beds of what had been formerly two fish ponds, which were now nothing more than stagnant swamps overgrown with rank weeds. And there, and here and there, encroached upon by the scraggling underwood, the avenue itself was much broken, and in many places the stones were almost concealed by grass and needles. The loose stone walls, which had here and there intersected the broad park, were, in many places, broken down, so as no longer to answer their original purpose as fences. Piers were now and then to be seen, but the gates were gone, and to add to the general air of dilapidation, some huge trunks were lying scattered through the venerable old trees, either the work of the winter storms, or perhaps the victims of some extensive but desultory scheme of denudation, which the projector had not capital or perseverance to carry into full effect. After the carriage had traveled a full mile of this avenue, we reached the summit of a rather abrupt eminence, one of the many which added to its picturesqueness, if not to the convenience of this rude approach. From the top of this ridge, the gray walls of Carrickley were visible, rising at a small distance in front, and darkened by a horary of wood which crowded around them in a quadrilangular building of considerable extent. And the front, where the great entrance was placed, lay towards us and bore unequivocal marks of antiquity. The time-worn, solemn aspect of the old building, the ruinous and deserted appearance of the whole place, and the associations which connected it with a dark page in the history of my family, combined to depress spirits already predisposed for the reception of somber and dejecting impressions. When the carriage drew up in the grass-grown courtyard before the hall door, two lazy-looking men, whose appearance well accorded with that of the place which they had tenanted, alarmed by the obstreperous barking of a great chained dog, ran out from some half-ruinous outhouses and took charge of the horses. The hall door stood open, and I entered a gloomy and imperfectly lighted apartment, and I found no one within it. However, I had not long to wait in this awkward predicament, for before my baggage had been deposited in the house, indeed, before I had well removed my cloak and other muffles, so as to enable me to look around, a young girl ran lightly into the hall, and kissing me heartily and somewhat boisterously exclaimed, "My dear cousin, my dear Margaret, I am so delighted, so out of breath, we did not expect you till 10 o'clock. My father is somewhere about the place. He must be close at hand. James, Corny, run out and tell your master. My brother is seldom at home, at least at any reasonable hour. You must be so tired, so fatigued. Let me show you to your room. See that Lady Margaret's luggage is all brought up. You must lie down and rest yourself. Deborah, bring some coffee up these stairs. We are so delighted to see you. You cannot think how lonely I have been, how steep these stairs are they not? I am so glad you have come. I can hardly bring myself to believe that you are really coming. How good of you, dear lady. How good of you, dear Lady Margaret." There is a real good nature and delight in my cousin's greeting, and a kind of constitutional confidence of manner which placed me at once at ease and made me feel immediately upon terms of intimacy with her. The room into which she ushered me, although partaking in the general air of decay which pervaded the mansion and all about it, had nevertheless been fitted up with evident attention to comfort, and even with some dingy attempt at luxury. But what pleased me most was that it opened by a second door upon a lobby which communicated with my fair cousin's apartment, a circumstance which divested the room in my eyes of the air of solitude and sadness which would otherwise have characterized it, to a degree almost painful to one so depressed and agitated as I was. After some arrangements, as I found necessary, were completed, we both went down to the parlor, a large wainscoted room hung round with gold, with grim old portraits, and, as I was not sorry to see, containing in its ample grate a large and cheerful fire. Here my cousin had leisure to talk more at her ease, and from her I learned something of the manners and the habits of the two remaining members of her family, whom I had not yet seen. On my arrival I had known nothing of the family among whom I was come to reside, except that it consists of three individuals, my uncle, and his son, and his daughter. Lady Tyrell having been long dead, in addition to this very scanty stock of information, I shortly learned from my communicative companion that my uncle was, as I had suspected, completely retired in his habits, and besides that, having been so far back as she could well recollect, always rather strict, as reformed rakes frequently become. He had latterly become growing more gloomy and sternly religious than heretofore. Her account of her brother was far less favorable, though she did not say anything directly to his disadvantage. From all that I could gather from her, I was led to suppose that he was a specimen of the idle, coarse-mannered, profligate squirrelarchy, a result which might naturally have followed from the circumstance of his being, as it were, outlawed from society, and driven for companionship to grades below his own, enjoying, too, the dangerous prerogative of spending a good deal of money. However, you may easily suppose that I found nothing in my cousin's communication fully to bear me out in so very decided a conclusion. I awaited the arrival of my uncle, which was every moment to be expected, with feelings half of alarm, half of curiosity, a sensation which I had often since experienced, though to a less degree, which upon the point of standing for the first time in the presence of one of whom I had been long in the habit of hearing or thinking with interest, it was therefore with some little protuberation that I heard first a slight bustle at the outer door, then a slow step traverse the hall, and finally witnessed the door open and my uncle enter the room. He was a striking-looking man, from peculiarities both of person and of dress. The whole effect of his appearance amounted to extreme singularity. He was tall, and when young his figure must have been strikingly elegant. As it was, however, its effect was marred by a very decided stoop. His dress was of a sober color, and in fashion interior to anything which I could remember. It was, however, handsome, and by no means carelessly put on. What completed the singularity of his appearance was his uncut white hair, which hung in long but not all neglected curls, even so far as his shoulders, and which, combined with his regularly classic features and fine dark eyes, to bestow upon him an air of venerable dignity and pride, which I have seldom seen equaled elsewhere. I rose as he entered and met him about the middle of the room. He kissed my cheek in both hands, saying, "You are most welcome, dear child, as welcome as the command of this poor place and all that it contains can make you. I am rejoiced to see you, truly rejoiced. I trust that you are not much fatigued. Pray, be seated again." He led me to my chair and continued, "I am glad to perceive you have made an acquaintance with Emily already. I see, in your being thus brought together, the foundation of a lasting friendship. You are both innocent and both young. God bless you. God bless you, and make you all that I could wish." He raised his eyes and remained for a few moments silent, as if in secret prayer. I felt that it was impossible that this man, with feelings manifestly so tender, could be the wretch that public opinion had represented him to be. I was more than ever convinced of his innocence. His manners were, or appeared to me, most fascinating. I know not how the lights of experience might have altered this estimate, but I was then very young, and I beheld in him a perfect mingling of the courtesy of polished life with the gentlest and most genial virtues of the heart. A feeling of affection and respect towards him began to spring up within me, the most earnest that I had remembered, how sorely he had suffered in fortune, and how cruelly in fame. My uncle, having given me fully to understand that I was most welcome and might command whatever was his own, pressed me to take some supper, and on my refusing, he observed that, before bidding me good night, had one duty further to perform, one which he was convinced I would cheerfully acquiesce. He proceeded to read a chapter from the Bible, after which he took his leave with the same affectionate kindness with which he had greeted me, having repeated his desire that I should consider everything in his house as altogether at my disposal. It is needless to say how much I was pleased with my uncle. It was impossible to avoid being so, and I could not help saying to myself, "If such a man as this is not safe from the assaults of slander, who is?" I felt much happier than I had done since my father's death, and enjoyed that night the first refreshing sleep which had visited me since that calamity. My curiosity respecting my male cousin did not remain long unsatisfied. He appeared upon the next day at dinner. His manners, though not as coarse as I had expected, were exceedingly disagreeable, and there was an assurance and a forwardness for which I was not prepared. There was less of the vulgarity of manner, and almost more that of the mind that I had anticipated. I felt quite uncomfortable in his presence. There was just that confidence in his look and tone which would read encouragement even in mere toleration, and I felt more disgusted and annoyed at the coarse and extravagant compliments which he was pleased from time to time to pay me than perhaps the extent of the atrocity might fully have warranted. It was, however, one consolation that he did not often appear, being much engrossed by pursuits about which I neither knew nor cared anything. But when he did, his attentions, either with a view to his amusement or to some more serious object, were so obviously and perseveringly directed to me that, young and inexperienced as I was, even I could not be ignorant of their significance. I felt more provoked by this odious persecution than I can express, and discouraged him with so much vigor that I did not stop even at rudeness to convince him that his assiduities were unwelcome, but all in vain. This had gone on for nearly a 12-month to my infinite annoyance, when one day, as I was sitting at some needlework with my companion Emily, as was my habit, in the parlor the door opened and my cousin Edward entered the room. There was something I thought odd in his manner, a kind of struggle between shame and impudence, a kind of flurry and ambiguity which made him appear, if possible, more than ordinarily disagreeable. "Your servant, ladies," he said, seating himself at the same time. "Sorry to spoil your tete-a-tete, but never mind. I'll only take Emily's place for a minute or two, and then we part for a while, fair cousin. Emily, my father wants you in the corner turret. No shilly-shally, he's in a hurry." She hesitated. "Be off, tramp. March, I say," he exclaimed in a tone which the poor girl dared not disobey. She left the room, and Edward followed her to the door. He stood there for a minute or two as if reflecting what he should say, perhaps satisfying himself that no one was within hearing in the hall. At length he turned about, having closed the door as if carelessly, with his foot, and slowly advancing in deep thought, he took a seat at the side of the table opposite to mine. There was a brief interval of silence, after which he said, "I imagine that you have a shrewd suspicion of the object of my early visit, but I suppose I must go into particulars, must I?" "I have no conception," I replied, "what your object may be." "Well, well," said he, becoming more at ease as he proceeded, "it may be told in a few words. You know that it is totally impossible, quite out of the question, that an offhand fellow like me, and a good-looking girl like yourself, could meet continually, as you and I have done, without an attachment, a liking growing upon one side or other. In short, I think I have let you know, as plainly as if I spoke it, that I have been in love with you, almost from the first time I saw you." He paused, but I was much too horrified to speak. He interpreted my silence favorably. "I can tell you," he continued, "I'm reckoned rather hard to please and very hard to hit. I can't say when I was taken with a girl before, so you see, fortune reserved me." Here, the odious wretch actually put his arm around my waist. The action at once restored me to utterance, and with the most indignant vehemence, I released myself from his hold, and at the same time said, "I have, sir, of course perceived your most disagreeable attentions. They have long been a source of great annoyance to me, and you must be aware that I have marked my disapprobation, my disgust, as unequivocally as I possibly could, without actual indelicacy." I paused, almost out of breath from the rapidity with which I had spoken, and without giving him time to renew a conversation, I hastily quitted the room, leaving him in a paroxysm of rage and mortification. As I ascended the stairs, I heard him open the parlor door with violence, and take two or three rapid strides in the direction which I was moving. I was now much frightened and ran the whole way until I reached my room, and having locked the door, I listened breathlessly but heard no sound. This relieved me for the present, but so much had I been overcome by the agitation and annoyance attendant upon the scene which I had yet passed through, that when my cousin Emily knocked at the door, I was weeping in great agitation. You will readily conceive my distress when you reflect upon my strong dislike to my cousin Edward, combined with my youth and extreme inexperience. Any proposal of such a nature must have agitated me, but that it should come from the man whom, of all others, I instinctively most loathed and abhorred, and to whom I had, as clearly as manner could do it, expressed the state of my feelings, which was almost too annoying to be borne. It was a calamity, too, in which I could not claim the sympathy of my cousin Emily, which had always been extended to me in my minor grievances. Still, I hoped that it might not be unattended with good, for I thought that one inevitable and most welcome consequence would result from this painful esclarecement is in the discontinuance of my cousin's odious persecution.
Good night, Grandma. Good night.